It's Lars Larson. Thanks for listening to my podcast and for listening to The Lars Larson Show. Are you approaching retirement, or maybe you've just changed jobs? If so, you'll probably now have control of your 401k or IRA. Would you like to buy some property, notes, loans, start a new business, or even buy crypto? You can with a self-directed IRA. For more than a decade, I've been telling you about setting up a self-directed IRA through IRA Advantage. And while you may now hear other companies say they offer self-directed IRAs, you need to find out if they're truly self-directed. With a truly self-directed retirement account, you can make any investment the law allows. Whether you're talking about true diversification, starting your new business, or investing in private holdings, IRA Advantage through a truly self-directed IRA can make that happen. Take it from me, Lars. You've worked hard for your money. IRA Advantage will work hard to keep it yours.
Would you like to learn more about truly self-directed IRAs? Then visit IRAAdvantage.com. View our videos and call IRA Advantage. That's IRAAdvantage.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to Monday on the Radio Northwest Network. We love to serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and we try to provide honestly provocative talk radio on a daily basis. So, glad to have you join the conversation. If you want to join in person, all you've got to do is call me up at 866-HEY-LARS. Naysayers always go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You can send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Now, we have a primary election in Oregon a week from tomorrow. Now, does that mean we'll know the results by Wednesday? Probably not, because a number of mistakes have been made, including badly printed ballots. But let me get to vote by mail in a moment, because I think vote by mail is one of the worst things that has ever happened to representative government in America. I'll back that up in just a moment. First, though, I want to suggest that you vote in our Twitter poll. In our Twitter poll, we put up a brand new question each and every day from the news of the day. Now, it's the 9th of May. About 9 days from now, one school district in Oregon is going to do something, and I think they'll probably carry through with it, and then they'll likely be followed by a number of other school districts around the state. This is the first time in about 30 years that this has been possible, because until the legislature passed a bill that made it legal in the 2021 session, school districts and other local governments around the state could not ban concealed carry. Now, the reason they did it that way, it was done under the failed and disgraced former governor John Kitzhaber when he was in the Oregon Senate, and under Vera Katz when she was House Speaker. So it was that long ago, in the early 1990s, that they passed the concealed carry law. Both of them are Democrats, by the way, but they agreed to allow Oregonians to have a permit to carry a gun. I have one of those permits. I've had it since the early 1990s, not long after it became law. And one of the concerns they had was they said, we don't want a patchwork quilt. That's the way they described it. A patchwork quilt of rules and regs around the state. And yet we're about to see that happen, because last year, the Oregon legislature passed something called Senate Bill 554. And what it allows is it allows every single local government, which includes school districts, it includes port districts, it includes cities, it includes counties, it includes every kind of government in the state, to pass its own individual and, in many cases, different rules when it comes to concealed carry. Now you say, why do I care about that? Well, I go to Oregon on a regular basis. Tina and I live in Washington State, but we go to Oregon. In 9 days, the Eugene 4J School District, which is the biggest school district in Lane County, is planning to pass a prohibition on concealed carry on campus. Now, I know that for some of you, they say, yeah, we shouldn't allow guns to be carried on campus. Let me tell you the practical effect of that. The practical effect is that right now, every single citizen, if they want to, can carry a gun on a school campus. When I've gone to give speeches to high school groups, I routinely carry. And it's not a big deal, because it's been legal. Now it's not. And you say, well, that'll make the kids safer. That's actually the Twitter poll for today. Does banning concealed carry on school grounds make students safer or not? I would argue it makes them not safer. And here's why. There are people out there who occasionally go to a school and they intend to do evil. Sometimes it's a student, sometimes it's been a teacher, sometimes it's been a regular citizen who's not connected to the school. When they do that, up till now, they know that some of the people on that campus are carrying guns. And the bad guy does not know who the good guy or the good gal is, which makes that school safer. The minute you announce to all the bad guys out there, whoever they happen to be, that when you go to a school campus, you know that unless there's a school resource officer, and most of them have been given the bum's rush out of schools by the liberal Democrats who run the schools and by the teachers' unions, unless there's a cop there, that means the bad guy can go and do whatever he chooses to do and will not be met with any kind of force that would stop a bad guy with a gun. So I would argue that banning concealed carry makes students less safe on school campuses. So keep an eye on that. Vote in our Twitter poll, at Lars Larson Show. It's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, about vote by mail. I don't like vote by mail. There was a time where I thought, well, it's probably not a bad idea. Having seen it, and Oregon is one of the longest standing vote by mail systems in America, and then seeing what was done during the pandemic over the last 2 years, where we didn't need vote by mail, but many states decided to adopt it, and many of them did it illegally because only their legislature could change the rules. But we have a primary election coming up a week from tomorrow. Let me read you one email I got from R.L. Zimmerman, who said, a quick update on voter fraud, Lars. My brother and my daughter each got two ballots each. I got two ballots each. One error out of hundreds of thousands might be an anomaly. Three out of three is a clear pattern. And I think that's right. When they flush all these extra ballots out there, some people will do the legitimate thing, vote one, toss the rest, tear them up, and make sure they're destroyed. But I think vote by mail actually drives down citizen participation. Let me give you a couple of examples. I've been getting emails the last 2 weeks from people saying, I don't understand. I got a ballot, but it doesn't include any Democrats or it doesn't include any Republicans. And I write back and I say, well, this is a primary election. Are you registered as a Republican or are you registered as a Democrat? And I usually get a note back saying, no, I've chosen to be non-affiliated, or I was automatically registered by the state and I'm not registered in any political party. Guess what? Primary elections are to pick the people who represent the Republican Party and the Democrat Party and the six other parties that are given official representation in the state. How do you get that representation? You get more than a certain percentage of the votes in a certain number of elections, and you can become an official party. Eight different parties are recognized in the state of Oregon, not just Democrats, not just Republicans, but Libertarians and four others. So you get a voice if you decide to be part of that party. If you're not, then you don't. For example, this one came in from Joe. Lars, my name's Joe. I have an 18-year-old first-time voter in the family. He received a ballot, but he only has the option of picking a few local races and nothing in the major governor's race. My party said it's a non-party ballot. He wants to vote for governor, but he's unable to. My wife and 22-year-old daughter also got their ballots, or they haven't come yet. Thanks for any advice. My advice is, if you want to pick the Republican candidate for governor, you need to already be registered as a Republican. If you are not a Republican, you don't get to pick the Republican candidate for governor. If you're not a Democrat, you don't get to pick from one of the two lousy choices, Tobias Reed and Tina Kotek. The last thought I want to give to you, there was a bipartisan report, a presidential commission headed up by Jimmy Carter and former Secretary of State James Baker. In 2005, they said this: absentee ballots, which is the way most of the country knew vote by mail back then, remain the largest source of potential voter fraud. I think that is still true today, and it's probably even worse today. Glad to be with you on a Monday. Always glad to get your calls. Coming up, the Democrat death cult is on a roll as the Supreme Court leak tells us they may overturn Roe v. Wade. I'll get to my comments on that next.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
Well, the Democrat death cult is on a roll over the last week as the Supreme Court is expected to overturn its colossal mistake made in Roe v. Wade about 50 years ago. Last week, pro-abortion forces damaged a crisis pregnancy center in Portland. A similar center in Wisconsin was set on fire this past weekend. Both places offer help to young pregnant moms who want to deliver a baby and give it up to loving adoptive parents instead of aborting it. When groups threatened to publicize the home addresses of Supreme Court justices, President Joe Biden and his spokeswoman Jen Psaki said they were not going to take any position on where people protest. They could have easily objected to it. They did not. Protests have now made it to Associate Justice Brett Kavanaugh and Chief Justice John Roberts homes. This is wrong. And by the way, it's a lie that the Supreme Court's decision would abolish abortion. It only sends the decision back to citizens in each of the 50 states. And about 23 of those states probably would make abortion very, very limited. But the other half of the states would actually keep on some of the no limits kinds of laws. Oregon is a good example of that, where there is no limit whatsoever on abortion. Polls show that about 71% of voters support some limits on abortion, and 54% support a 15-week limit on killing the unborn. That is the very number, 15 weeks, at the center of the Mississippi case that the Supreme Court is deciding right now. The problem is Democrats in America favor abortion right up to the moment of birth, and bizarrely, some of them even favor the right to kill a baby after it's been born. With a death cult like that and violent protests and a Biden White House signing off on threatening judges, we all know this ain't going to end well. From Twitter, this comment came in. Dinesh D'Souza, we talked about his movie. I saw it this past weekend, the documentary. The CDC is geo-tracking people to see if they are social distancing. If geo-tracking were not as highly precise and accurate as the bogus fact checkers claim, how could the CDC use it to determine if people are standing 6 feet apart from one another? And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you
ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
I'm going to give the Daily Grill to the growing influence of people who've decided that the police need not be respected. And my case in point comes out of Eugene. Three police officers in Eugene were injured when they tried to break up a house party on Saturday night. 200 people were there. It ended with one person arrested, others being ticketed. This unruly gathering of both college-age people and some of their parents. It happened in Eugene. When police arrived, some of the crowd began to leave, but some partiers and their mothers began taking pictures in front of the police car, displaying their middle fingers. With the partiers then in the streets, officers tried to clear the road. Authorities said one man, William Maxwell Creever, refused police officers and then punched an officer in the face as he was being taken into custody. Then Creever's parents were among those who tried to stop the arrest. As far as I'm concerned, mom and dad should have been arrested as well. Creever was booked for assaulting a public safety officer, two counts of assault, interfering, resisting arrest, and disorderly conduct. This kind of growing trend toward we don't care what the cops say, this is not going to end well for anybody. I do want to mention this. I've talked about him before, but the late Jerry Frank, who passed away not long ago, Oregon's premier citizen, there will be a tribute to him held at the Salem Convention Center Thursday, May 19th, 10 days from now, at 10 o'clock in the morning. They're even going to serve chocolate cake from Jerry Frank's famous Conditori will be served at the tribute. For RSVP and more info, email gwfcelebration@gmail.com. And if you missed that, just shoot me a note. I'll get it taken care of. From our email, brought to you by Mobile Joe's RV Collision. Get back on the open road and back to your adventure with Mobile Joe's. No body damage, too big or small, collision or paint repairs. Mobile Joe's RV Collision fixes them all. Rocky writes in, Lars, last week during your show, you brought to our attention 2,000 Mules. Thanks for that, because had you not, we never would have seen it. I did indeed watch the show and was not surprised by the theft of the 2020 election. Trump was right. Pence needs to go away. However, what I'm surprised at is that none of the mainstream news media agencies this weekend posted the story, not even Fox or Newsmax. So it's okay for the Dems to go after the Supreme Court by breaching the integrity of the High Court and leaking out a decision. But when it comes to election integrity, nope, nothing to see here. Move along. I bet the Biden administration will direct the FBI to sit this one out. Further, according to the Dems, COVID will be a real thing this fall, and we'll all have to vote by mail, where the 2,000 mules we saw in the 2020 election will be more like 20,000 mules. Sad times in our country, signed Rocky. Send those emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Let's start with Bob. Hey, Bob, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hello, Lars. Hey, this is Bob. And on the Ukrainian conflict, isn't it a national security and our best interest to go over there? Because, I mean, as an ally of Ukraine, shouldn't we go over there and join the conflict? Because as an ally, if Russia gains control of Ukraine, they're going to stop at Ukraine. They're going to keep going on over to others.
Okay,
in the,
Bob, here's where is the national security interest in going in and getting into a conflict with another nuclear-armed superpower like Russia? Can you tell me what the United States national security concern is?
Well, I mean, Russia gaining natural resources.
Do you mean every time Russia's a country land decides to grab natural resources from one of its neighbors, we should get into a conflict with a nuclear-armed opponent? That doesn't sound like a good idea to me. You can't tell me what the national security concern is, can you?
That's a bedbath basket of the world, right there.
It is, and should we every time wheat is put in danger, should the United States wade into a war?
No, I'm not saying that, but the resources. That's Russia's limiting factor in this whole thing is their food. And if they get Ukraine, they'll be able to pull in a tremendous amount of food. And then they'll be able, and instead of the U.S. being a major exporter of food, Russia will be able to supply. We don't really want our enemy supplying the world with food.
Do you know the United States is a major exporter of food, and we pay farmers not to farm 40 million acres of land in this country? If you ever think that the United States is not going to continue to be a major exporter of food, I think you are a bit mistaken. But thank you very much. It was a good naysayer call. Coming up, one of the major names running for the Republican nomination for governor in Oregon is Bob Tiernan. Bob joins me next on the Radio Northwest Network. Then we'll get to more of your phone calls and your emails. It's a Monday, and it's a pleasure to be with you on the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. We've got a primary election for governor next Tuesday in Oregon, and one of the candidates running is Bob Tiernan, former state representative and former Oregon Republican Party chair. He'd like to get the nomination and then run to replace Kate Brown. Bob, welcome back.
Hey, Lars, how you doing?
I'm not doing too badly. Why don't I give you the shot first? What do you think are the major issues that are going to decide this with such a rich field of Republicans running for the nomination?
Well, first off, there's a lot of nice people running, no question. I think the bottom line is who has the actual proven experience to fix the problems that are facing the state. And I think if you look at my resume, you look at my background, my experience, my accomplishment in business as a commander in the Navy, in the legislature as chairman of the Crime and Corrections Committee, every major problem we have in this state is solvable. But it's easy to say, it's hard to do. It takes somebody who has the proven leadership that has done this before. I've done it in business. I've done it in the military. I've done it in the legislature. I think, Lars, that's what it comes down to. Who can get the job done? And I just ask people to look at your voter's pamphlet statement. Look at the voter's pamphlet. My statement is right next to Christine Drazen's. Read hers. Read mine, Bob Tiernan. Who would you want flying that 737 as the pilot with all your family and your kids and your whole wherewithal on that plane? Who would you want?
Drazen is not at the top of my list. I mean, she's on the list, but she's not at the top of my list for the reason that I think she was a huge disappointment as the minority leader in the legislature. Let me ask you this then. Before I get to, I think, a really critical question, how would you, as governor, without assuming that you'll have a Republican legislature to change the laws, how would you address crime and the dramatic increase in violent crime in this state, assuming you can't change any laws? Because I don't think you're assuming that you're going to have a Republican legislature if you become governor in January of next year, are you?
No, I don't think we will. I hope we do, but hope and change doesn't get the job done. What we need, we have enough laws on the books. You know, between Measure 11 and all the other criminal laws we have, we've got the laws. What we need to do is enforce our criminal justice process. We need to have enough cops. We need to have a prosecutor who is going to prosecute, and we need to have the judges and the jury, you know, to sentence those people in the prison and in jail space. And luckily, we've got jail space. State police. Governor has complete control over the state police. They got 500 or plus sworn officers. If we have to move state resources, I will do that. The National Guard. If we have an emergency, we have a riot, we have things that are going out of control in Portland or even in other areas. You just can't tolerate that because the governor's number one job is to keep Oregonians safe. So would I utilize the National Guard if necessary, absolutely necessary? You bet I would. There are the resources. There are the I call levers of solutions the governor can pull. They are the leader. They're responsible for all of state of Oregon. So if one city can't handle it and they got to backfill it, they have to enforce the laws. That's what I'll do because that is be my number one priority.
But then you send the state police, and let's say they go to places like Portland and Eugene that are out of control for crime, and they make arrests. The charging decisions are still made by local district attorneys, or I guess you could hand them over to the very left-wing Attorney General of Oregon, even if you could go that direction. Is that going to get it done?
You know, you need the prosecutors. We have 36 elected prosecutors. We need to have them do their job. And that is when somebody breaks the law, no matter what it is, whether it's shoplifting or breaking a window or throwing a can or committing arson or murder or whatever they're doing, they have to prosecute. If they don't, we have a way to resolve that. And it's called the voting booth. And if you don't want to wait, we can recall them. Personally, if the Multnomah County District Attorney would not do his job, he would not prosecute felons who are causing havoc in Portland, I would lead a recall against that prosecutor. And guess who appoints his successor? That's right, the governor. So there's always a solution. I have never seen a problem, Lars, in business, military, in the legislature. There's always a solution. The question is, you know, can you dial in the solution? Do you have, you know, the backbone to do it? Are you willing to go to all out measures to get the job done? And do you know how to do it? That's what I do. And all right. So, yeah, we have serious problems, but it takes a serious leader to fix them.
Bob, tell me this. Do you think Oregonians who vote next Tuesday can count on their being a legitimate election, a solid election, when their vote actually counts and we don't count the votes of non-voters or fake votes?
You know, Lars, that's a $64 question. I can answer it this way. I hope so. We have 36 counties. All of the counties are run by separate elected officials. And I know that, you know, most of them are very good people. The counties I worry about are Lane and Multnomah. I worry about the, you know, dead people voting. I worry about dumping them, collecting, you know, I would say hundreds, but
harvesting
from picking them up. I hope it is. And as governor, I tell you, one of the first things we got to do is have an audit of our entire system. And I just mean an audit. We have to take a hard look at how people are registering, how they are sending in their ballots. And this ballot harvesting, I think, is wrong. It's got to stop. So there's lots of things we can do to help the integrity. But that's a tough question.
Me get to the really tough question. Did Joe Biden win legitimately in 2020?
Oh, boy. You know, because President Trump lost Georgia, I think he did. And the reason why I say I have no doubt there was funny business going on in Pennsylvania, in Michigan,
Georgia,
I have no doubt there,
and in Georgia.
Corruption.
Have you seen 2,000 Mules yet, Bob?
I haven't seen it. I was just sent it.
You're aware, though, that they've proved that there was ballot harvesting to the tune of tens of thousands of votes. Can you legitimately say, because I understand that in the debate on Coin TV, you said Biden won legitimately. Do you stand by that?
You know, I'm going to have to do my homework before I say that. Let me watch the video.
Did you say that, though? Did you say on Coin's debate that Joe Biden won legitimately? Despite everything we've heard over the last year and a half, you think Biden won legitimately?
I think he won. That's correct.
Wow. I'll tell you what. Why don't you make this deal? Later on today, I'm going to point out both the pluses and the minuses to 2,000 Mules. Most of it is I don't think Dinesh connected all the dots that should have been connected. I used to make documentaries for a living. It was a good documentary. It was not a great documentary. Would you agree to watch that documentary front to back about the ballot harvesting in Georgia and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and in other states? And then I want to know if you stand by the idea that Joe Biden won legitimately. Would you agree to do that?
Oh, absolutely, Lars. I think it should be completely, fully, everything washed out, investigated, and fix the problems. The main problem is, unless we have hard evidence that it was illegitimate, and if this is hard evidence, then so be it. But unless we have hard evidence, we have to support our democratic system.
You want to make me a bet? I'll tell you what, you're a wealthy guy, Bob. I'll bet you $50 after you watch 2,000 Mules, and after you watch the info from True the Vote, you're going to see absolute hard data, the kind of data you used to use in the military. And I'm talking about cell phone tracking and everything else. My bet, and I'd bet you $50 right now against this, that you will be convinced there is hard data and you'll rescind the statement about the legitimacy of the Biden win. You want to bet me $50?
Well, let me say this, Lars. You're a very smart guy. So if you've seen it and you have questions, I'm going to have questions.
I don't have
too.
Questions. No. I know that election was stolen. I just wish you knew it was stolen as well. That's Bob Tiernan. He's running for the Republican nomination for governor in Oregon. And you're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. That's right, it is. And it's the Radio Northwest Network. You can email talk@LarsLarson.com. I wish I could share half of the roughly 1,100 emails I get every single day. Sometimes it's as low as 900, sometimes as low as 1,500, or as high as 1,500. Todd writes in from Eugene, listening on the Radio Northwest Network and KPNW. Lars, anybody, and that includes the Georgia governor and secretary of state, that can watch the State Farm Arena flood go away, observers, ballots under the table, count them over and over video, and say there weren't any felonies committed is a liar. And I would have to agree with you. Let's go to your calls now at 866 Hey Lars, starting with Dan. Hey Dan, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Bob Tiernan.
Bob Tiernan running for the Republican nomination for governor. What'd you make of that?
Well, what I find interesting is we're always talking about, you know, these swing states that, you know, whether or not they were legitimate with the election. But if you look at Oregon, I mean, I personally had a friend that received two official voter envelopes.
Yep. In fact, I've had emails. I've had emails in the last few days, and I've said to people, if you got two ballots, send me pictures of them. I want to see proof. And they send me pictures of two ballots. There are people out there getting two ballots in this primary election. Can you imagine what they're going to do in the general? I think there's cheating that's gone on in Oregon and Washington for literally decades, and it has to be found out, and it can be found out. But Jimmy Carter warned 15 years ago that vote by mail was the biggest opportunity for fraud in America.
Yeah. I just wanted to make the point that it's not just swing states. I mean, it's every state that needs to be looked into.
I agree with you. The only reason we focus on the swing states, as you know, is that the swing states made the difference in the final election. But, you know, it's not true that only under vote by mail have we had Democrat governors, but we've had Democrat governors now for a third of a century. And most of that third of a century has been under vote by mail. And that is a big problem. Let's go to Ron in Salem. Hey, Ron, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
You know what it reminds me of, Lars? Greg Woolridge, because he didn't do no campaign, registered at the last moment at the same time.
You're talking about Tiernan, right?
Yes. And at the same time, I like the man. But where were you Where were you at during the timber rally? Where were you at when the crowd started going up, going back to Obama, when the homelessness started going up around Salem, Dallas, all the other rural areas since the 2014? Where were you at? You've been silent for 10 years. You're fundraising. You're based on what I read on the oldest report from the Secretary of State. You can look online, people, from the Secretary of State's office, and you can see $500,000. Not Oregon money, California money. Why you move your company to the highest tax state in the country, and yet you saying you stand for my values? To me, Lars, my final answer is this, as they would say on the one show, whose line is anyway? If you see a lie, it's a lie. You cannot go through and change it. I like his fire, but at the same time, it's too late when I've been in the dungeons as a Republican for over 6 years, lifetime, but 6 years in the party and seeing him sit silent on the sidelines. I'm tired of these rhinos that is not doing the job, but they want to go through and say they got the cures and answers. There's only two candidates I see, and I'll make my decision tonight. It's okay. Mark Thielman and Bridget Barton.
Well, I think that's what it comes down to, Ron, and that's where we're going to have to go. Let me sneak in Chris Mann, who's running for Oregon's first congressional district or first legislative district, Chris?
First congressional district.
Very good. Give your best pitch to my audience. Why should they elect you to Congress?
All right, Lars, thank you so much for giving me the time. I'm a 21-year Army veteran. I'm born and raised here in Oregon. And I've seen what it's like in other countries, and I see the way the direction of our country is going right now. We need to stop this almost 180-degree turn of our freedoms and give them back to the people. So when I get into office, I want to get us back up and being energy dependent. I want to be a major exporter of energy, get the economy flowing better, get gas lowered for our truck drivers and truck driving companies, which then also gives us back our money for lowering the cost of goods coming out to our stores. There's so many things going on in the country. I could vote on so many and talk about so many. Any other ones you want me to?
Well, here's what I'd like you to do. Tell people where to find your social media. They'll read all your positions, and they'll know you the best that way. Where can they find you?
Absolutely, Lars. They can just go straight to chrismancan.com, and my last name is with two N's. So it's chrismancan.com. They'll direct you right to my site, and you can also send me an email or ask me any questions, and I promise to give you a response in less than 48 hours.
Sounds great. Now, I'm going to get myself in trouble. Bruce, you're a naysayer. We're a minute and a half from the break. What do you and I disagree about?
The election, Lars. You are provocative radio, and you say that. You're number one provocative radio in America, or the Northwest.
Honestly, provocative
the reason
radio.
The reason you are is because of bringing up subjects like the election. Just keep it going. Just keep get your listeners going. You know darn well what the truth is.
I know there was cheating, and you tell me if I know.
Now, there was COVID, and there were some rules changes. I ain't argue that. I don't know about, that was.
The Constitution says the only entity in any state that can change the rules is the legislature. Many of those states change the rules without the legislature. Could we at least agree that that was unconstitutional?
Yeah, I'm not going to argue. I won't argue that. No, I won't. I'm not going to say I agree, but I won't argue. But
okay, that's the bottom line then. Bruce, thanks for being a good naysayer. It's Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk. And I'm glad to get to your phone calls at 866-HEY-LARS. As you know, naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our Twitter poll today, based on the passage of a new law last year by the Oregon legislature in 2021, they passed Senate Bill 554. And what it allows is every single local government in the state of Oregon is allowed to make its own rules on concealed carry. That has not been true in about 30 years because the legislature said, We don't want a whole patchwork quilt of laws around the state. Well, now they're going to allow just that. Now, somebody suggested to me that the Eugene 4J School District, which is going to vote on the 18th, 9 days from now, to prohibit concealed handgun license holding parents from being anywhere near on their property. Now, if they do that, does that make students safer or not? I would vote for not. You can vote any way you like at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. And I'd love to have a naysayer on that who says the schools will be safer if you prohibit legal law-abiding citizens who have a carry permit, who are frankly more law-abiding on average than the average citizen is, and yet you're going to tell them you're not allowed to carry. I think it's going to result in a lot of people being accused of walking across the school grounds because there likely won't be any kind of limitation. Does this have to happen during school hours? No. You could be out walking your freaking dog and you walk across the school grounds. And at some point, a police officer says to you, why are you out here walking your dog at 10 o'clock at night? Can you tell me who you are? Show me your license, your driver's license. Can you identify yourself? If they look up your background and they say, it says here you have a carry permit. Are you carrying a gun tonight? Well, you're on school ground property. You are now a criminal. And does anybody think that that kind of limitation on concealed handgun licensees walking across school property or being on school property is going to catch a single bad guy? Any of the people who might mean to do harm to kids in school, do you think it'll stop any of them? Or will it most likely result in the conviction of law-abiding citizens? I think it's absolutely outrageous that they're doing this. Eugene 4J Schools, I'd be glad to take a naysayer. Now, we're going to put in a just the for the record call to Eugene 4J School board members. But I want to know if there are any board members who've actually got the spine to say this is a stupid idea. It's not going to make the schools safer. It arguably makes the schools put the kids at greater risk. If anybody on that 4J school district board would be willing to come on the air and suggest why this is a good idea, I'd love to talk to them. In the meantime, I want to talk to Sandeep Bali, who's running for the Portland City Council. Many times we say, well, if you voted for these people, then you put them on the council, and the stupid decisions they make that put your life at risk, they're the result of voters making choices. Well, at least in this case, there is some kind of choice. There's Joanne Hardesty, there's Dan Ryan, there are all these people that are on the board right now. Sandeep, welcome back to the program, and tell people listening why they should vote for you and put you on the council and how you'd be different than the members that are on the council right now.
Hello, Lars. Thank you so much for having me and for getting me back on the show. I really appreciate it. Really, I think for me running for council, it is because I am a Portland resident. And when I look around Portland, I see that Portland is headed in a place that I don't agree with any longer. And I think I'm basically running to prevent that from happening and to prevent Portland from getting any worse. Some of the platforms that I'm running on right now are to end urban camping. I'm saying that we must totally turn off the free-flowing spigot that has basically told everybody in the nation to come to Portland, where you can freely do drugs, you can freely commit crimes, and you can urban camp. I think we're allowing mental health to go untreated, and we're allowing addiction to go untreated, and those are things that we should definitely be addressing and looking at and providing hope to people, and not just letting them live amongst their own waste and garbage and tents all over the city. Number two, I'm saying we must increase public safety. Right now, Portland has a huge public safety issue, and that resulted from our council members championing the defunding of the police, championing 100 days of riots in downtown. And they have flip-flopped on defunding the police after they defunded them for $23 million. They're saying, yes, let's refund them. Let's flip-flop and give them back $5.2 million. But I feel like that's too little, too late. We need to be a little bit more aggressive. And my plan and my goal is to bring back a diverse force of men and women who are really passionate about public safety. And then lastly, I think in Portland, we're running into an issue with the Safe Rec Villages. That is a policy that Dan Ryan is doubling down on as we speak. And what we're seeing is that he wants to introduce these safe rest villages into every single neighborhood in Portland, perhaps even go as far as having 70 safe rest villages throughout Portland.
And 70 of them?
Neighbors are pushing back.
70 of them?
Yes, sir. Yes. Because the question here, Dan, is where do you actually, how does a safe rest village solve the homeless crises? It can't. How many of them do you have to build for the homeless, you know, crises to end? And I think when we're looking at safe rest villages, so far what we're seeing is where they're putting these, they're putting them close to schools, they're putting them into neighborhoods. I've been out, I talked to the folks out in Lentz, where they're literally putting one into those neighbors' backyards, getting rid of what used to be a wildlife refuge and putting in a safe rest village. And I think that's really disappointing.
Sandeep, can I make a suggestion to you? I want you to, I'm fairly confident that the safe rest villages, like so many of the homeless shelters that are being sponsored by governments all over the Pacific Northwest, are what they call low barrier or housing first, meaning you can keep taking drugs, you can keep getting drunk, you can keep engaging in drug activity, which means you'll draw drug dealing and you'll draw criminal activity to those villages. If I'm wrong about that, I'm happy to correct it on the air. But I believe that they're telling these people, you can live in this safe rest village, keep shooting heroin, keep smoking methamphetamine, keep staying, you know, stay drunk. And we'll let you continue to live there with no expectation of changing the lives or the activities, the misbehavior, the antisocial behavior that left these people living on the streets to begin with. And I believe you should add that to the rhetoric that you've got on these things to say, do you want a village full of drug addicts and people who probably have to go out and steal to be able to supply their habit? Do you want that in your neighborhood? That is a critical part of this. And I can just about guarantee you, you're going to find that they are exactly that. Tell people where to find you on social media, please.
You can find me at betterwithvalley.com, and I'm also on Twitter, and I'm also on Instagram as well.
Very good. Better with Valley, B-A-L-I. Coming up in a moment, yes, I saw the 2000 Mules documentary. Yes, I liked a lot of it. And yes, I think it has flaws. I'm going to get into that. And then we'll get a naysayer on who might want to debate the issue of whether or not the 2020 election was legitimate. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
We have put together, I think, the most extensive and inclusive voter fraud organization in the history of American politics.
That literally is Joe Biden, and it's a real unedited soundbite. We've used it before on the show, but that one comes from one of the segments of a brand new documentary called 2000 Mules. Now, we talked about that last week with Dinesh D'Souza, the man who put together the documentary. It aired, or its premiere aired, this past weekend. It shows proof that as many as 800,000 votes were illegally cast in the 2020 presidential election. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to the best conversation in talk journalism. If you'd like to join in, it's very easy. In fact, I expect to have a naysayer on this very subject. Just call 866-HEY-LARS, and naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com, and vote in my Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show on Twitter or on my website at LarsLarson.com. And welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. Now, I had a lot of people asking me about 2000 Mules, both last week when we talked about it, and I imagine this week as well. I've known the documentary filmmaker Dinesh D'Souza for many years, and I consider him a friend. In fact, at one point, after he'd been convicted of an election law violation, one that most people get a slap on the wrist for, and he was ordered to basically house arrest every single night, I went out and I gave a speech in Montana subbing for him. His documentary provides solid proof that more than 2,000 human mules were used to illegally deliver hundreds of thousands of ballots in the November 3rd presidential election and shifted the apparent victory to Joe Biden, although Joe Biden did not win. That proof came from another group called True the Vote, a group I've also known about for more than a decade. I've talked to Catherine Engelbrecht, who is the young lady behind it. That is the good part. And what they provide, when you say, well, what's the proof, Lars? What they did was they took a massive amount of cell phone data, 10 trillion different pings, and they said, let's find the people who go to some of these particular nonprofit organizations and picked up batches of ballots and then delivered the ballots in the dead of night at 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning, in some cases, in other cases in broad daylight, and put those ballots in the drop box. And if you say, well, what's wrong with that? It's illegal to do that in the states in which they did it. Now, that is the good part, and I highly recommend that all of you watch the documentary. Take a listen to this.
Let me begin by asking a very simple question. Do we know the truth about what really happened in the 2020 election?
I think millions of Americans know something went wrong, and they have little pieces, and no one's really put it together.
I'm agnostic on this question, and I am awaiting more information.
If I believed the president were a Nazi, I might steal an election.
Now, I want to tell you what disappointed me about 2,000 Mules. They identified the mules. They used cell phone technology and official video from cameras placed by election authorities to monitor those drop boxes to show that the mules were illegally stuffing drop boxes. Take a listen to this.
We identified in Atlanta 242 mules that went to an average of 24 drop boxes. But Philadelphia alone, we've identified more than 1,100 mules.
What is a mule?
Person picking up ballots and running them to the drop boxes.
Now, the documentary could have gone to the mules themselves, the ones they actually identified, and many of them were people who took part in those riots in the summer of riots in both 2020 and 2021 and confronted them about their illegal acts. It did not. The documentary did identify that mules picked up ballots from five different nonprofit election groups and then dropped them in the boxes. It did not name the nonprofits, and it should have. It did not confront any of those who were involved in the illegal acts at the nonprofits. The documentary did identify a number of well-known talk hosts, people like me, who do my kind of job, and they asked their opinion. It did not go to the attorneys general of the battleground states where the illegal acts occurred and demand to know why those crimes are not being pursued. It didn't go to a single district attorney or prosecutor where the illegal acts happened and demand to know why an investigation was not underway.
It's not a leap to say this would have made a difference.
They have ruined Election Day in the United States of America. That's provable. And that's enough for me to fight the left with every fiber in my body.
Now, the documentary identified one man hired by the Republican Party to watch drop boxes in Georgia. He explains in the documentary that he witnessed illegal acts involving ballots. He explains he reported the information back to the GOP. What the documentary could have easily done but did not is demand that the GOP explain why it did not go to prosecutors and demand they take action. The documentary is, as I said, well worth watching. But most of the core of the truth about illegally stuffing ballot boxes with harvested ballots, that came from True the Vote, where it could have closed the loop by going to prosecutors, by going even to some of the mules it did not do, and it didn't explain why it didn't do that. Now, on that note, let's go to Will, who is a naysayer. Will, you're convinced that the election was not a fraud. Glad to have you on the show. Tell me what you and I disagree about.
I wish I had more than 3 minutes, but yeah, the reason why they didn't go to prosecutors is because there was no evidence, and they didn't want any lawsuits put forth against them. It's pretty simple, Lars.
There was no evidence. Now, what about the cell phone ping? So, in other words, they identify the same technique that was used by the CDC recently to determine whether or not people were socially distancing, things like that. They used the same kind of data to identify that people in the dead of night went to five different nonprofits, then went from there to a minimum of 10 different drop boxes. In many states, an average of 50 drop boxes in the middle of the night, and they have video of the people stuffing ballots into the boxes. How can you say there was no proof if that's what they offered up?
Because I understand what editing and documentaries is. What do you think the cell phone data proves? It shows Trump, Biden votes.
It doesn't show anything about Trump. But can I tell you why it matters? What would be the legitimate explanation for a person traveling to five different nonprofit groups that harvested ballots, picking up the ballots, and then illegally taking them to drop boxes, a minimum of 10 for each mule on each one of those trips? What would be the legitimate explanation for doing that kind of thing?
There's not, because it didn't happen. It's a bad documentary.
Well, no, hold on. When you say it didn't happen, you're saying the data doesn't show that their cell phone pings were not picked up?
Why didn't they release it, Lars? Why is it in a little documentary by a partisan?
Well, actually, they announced when they premiered. I'm going to answer your question, Will. They announced this weekend they're going to take all this data and post all of it publicly. So anybody who doubts, as you doubt. But why do you think they just faked this whole thing? Is that right?
Yeah, and Lars, you offered $50 for
no, but why do you believe that they faked the data?
Listen, Lars, I will offer you $500 to debate you to end this nonsense anywhere you want, your studio, wherever.
You can debate me right now. Go ahead. But all you're saying is you say it didn't happen. They're saying the data shows it did. They've offered to make all their data public, and I'd love to see what your proof is. When you just look at it and say, well, it didn't happen, no matter how much the data suggests that it did happen, no matter the fact that they use the same kind of data that's used by other government agencies, including the FBI, on January the 6th. I think you don't have much to back up what you're saying. True, the vote apparently does. I'm glad to have you with me. Glad to take your calls. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and your emails in just a moment. But I've been looking forward to talking to Paul Mango, who is the former Deputy Chief of Staff at Health and Human Services and author of a brand new book called Warp Speed, Inside the Operation That Beat COVID, the Critics and the Odds. Paul, welcome to the show.
Hey, Lars, it's great to be back with you. Thanks for having me.
You know, I've got to tell you, just in interest, I always tell my audience that I'll disclose if I think I have a dog in the fight. I'm deeply suspicious of the vaccine. So just understand that. And I'm very concerned about the effect that it's had on some people. Still in all, what Warp Speed did was a pretty amazing feat, if you put that caveat in there as well. Do you mind if we do that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll be happy to talk about the quality standards we used if you so desire as well.
All right. Very good. Well, tell me this, because an awful lot of people, if they listened just to Joe Biden, would get the impression that when he arrived in office and took the oath on January 20th of last year, there was no vaccine. Nobody was being vaccinated, even though Joe himself got the vaccine in the middle of December, his first shot and his second shot in January. So he would have you believe that nobody got it but him, and that there hadn't already been, I think, 10 or 12 million people vaccinated on the day he took the oath, and perhaps more than that. You know the numbers better than I do.
Yeah, Lars, I'd like to use a football metaphor, which is we had a team that drove the ball down 99 yards to the one-yard line. It was first and goal on the one-yard line, and they brought in a new quarterback. And, he leaned forward and fell into the end zone, and I think we have to give him credit for that. But the heavy lifting on this was in the 10 months preceding that inauguration day, and it's just an extraordinary tribute to America's private sector to get done what we got done in such a short period of time.
And perhaps it's the case that people listening to this might not realize just how long it usually takes to get any kind of vaccine through the approval process and the many hurdles that stand in the way. Would you mind going through that?
Sure. Well, the previous best time for bringing a safe and effective vaccine to market was the mumps vaccine, believe it or not, in the 1960s, and it was about 4 to 4.5 years. And we did this in 10 months. And by the way, in the 1960s, when they were developing the mumps vaccine, we weren't in the middle of a global pandemic where everyone was scrambling for equipment and raw materials and trained labor to get the vaccines manufactured. So really a reduction of 80% from in terms of the timeline from the previous world record for vaccine development and introduction.
I guess I've got a dog in the fight there, too, because my mom was a nurse and she was still alive at that point. And I remember her giving me the shot. And I said to her, why do I have to have this? Because I was 9 years old. And she said, because we don't want you to get we don't want you to get measles, and we don't want you to give it to, you know, in the worst case scenario, a pregnant woman. And would it be fair to say that the regulatory hurdles in the 1960s were probably considerably less than the massive amount of hurdles that the federal government has thrown up between the 60s and current time?
Yeah, and I think, Lars, part of it is the FDA's ability to digest and analyze reams of data automatically through spreadsheets and so forth is far different than it was in the 1960s. So I would say much more comprehensive, but I think there were two standards that it's important for the listeners to understand that were different for these vaccines than any prior vaccine. One is the typical average number of participants in a phase three clinical trial for vaccines in the past had been about 20,000. Well, the FDA established for these COVID vaccines a minimum of 30,000 participants, and Pfizer and Johnson & Johnson actually had over 40,000 in their trials. So many more persons had to go through these late-stage trials. And second, adverse reaction to a vaccine typically happens within 42 days of the time you get the vaccine. And for these trials, the FDA extended that 42 days to 60 days. So not only were there more persons in the trial, but there was a longer time period to evaluate whether or not there'd be an adverse reaction. And these aren't perfect vaccines. I think we've all read about some of the shortcomings, but in a relative sense, they're some of the safest and most effective vaccines ever delivered to the American people.
Okay, and that's one thing I'd love to have you address. I'm talking to Paul Mango, who's the former Deputy Chief of Staff at Health and Human Services. He's written a book called Warp Speed, Inside the Operation That Beat COVID, the Critics and the Odds. How do we address these concerns, and how do you satisfy people that many of whom, including me, believe that an awful lot of the data that is adverse is being held back by the government, that they're trying to soft play some of the downsides to these mRNA vaccines because they want people to take the vaccine. Now, I understand their desire to want them to take the vaccine, but on the other hand, you know, when you know that the vaccine adverse events reporting system, VAERS, which isn't comprehensive yep. either because it doesn't include no. every adverse event because it's not required the doctors put the information up there. But even that seems like tremendously frightening numbers. Even if you say statistically it's not likely to hurt you, I tell people I've got a jar with 1,000 jelly beans in it. Only one of them is deadly. Would you sample one of my 1,000 knowing that your chances of getting the deadly one are 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 10,000? Most people turn my jelly bean jar down.
Yeah, no, that's a good metaphor as well. I hopefully I can use that, and you won't mind me plagiarizing it a bit. But
please do.
I think Lars, here's the way, and this is what our administration was trying to do, and that is never impose a vaccine mandate on anyone. I'm firmly against the mandates, but what I'm in favor of is each individual having a conversation with his or her physician. No one knows the situation of a patient better than the patient and the physician. And, you know, this is always a trade-off. It is given your individual situation, your risk kind of profile, your age, your underlying health conditions, do the benefits of the vaccine outweigh the risks of the vaccine? And the answer to that question is very different by individual. And these vaccines yep. are not for everyone, but they are for, in general, those who have been shown to be most vulnerable to serious illness and death from COVID, and that's typically the elderly over age 65 or 70, and those with serious underlying health conditions. So it's a discussion with one's doctor. It should never be mandated. That's what I would recommend the listeners do.
See, and that's what I wanted, Paul. I wanted everybody to make their own decision based on their own total circumstances, you know, their family, what their activities are, what their underlying, you know, other health conditions. We all became familiar with comorbidities as a word that became almost in daily usage. But the problem is, like last week, there was a young lady, we talked about her on the show. She was going to school in upstate New York, and she'd already had the vaccine and a booster, and she had a really bad result from the booster, ended up in the emergency yeah. room. And then the college said, you have to take another shot. And she said, my doctor has told me not to. And the college said, we don't care. You're out. Pack your crap. Get out of school. You're gone. And they forced her out. And it's those kinds of activities that really have a lot of us distrusting the government and a lot of the healthcare institutions that have gone along with this.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Lars. And that is a definition of not following the science, despite what people say. So, you know, I think collectively the American people are a lot smarter about these things than some of these institutions. And I think it's very unfortunate what happened to that individual. Again, our administration would never have tried to impose anything like that. It's a shame that this administration feels differently.
It is because, you know, when Biden himself said, I'm not going to impose a vaccine mandate, and right away, they turn around and do exactly that. His new book is called Warp Speed, Inside the Operation That Beat COVID, The Critics and the Odds. He is Paul Mango, the former Deputy Chief of Staff at Health and Human Services. Paul, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. I'm glad to get your calls, including naysayer calls, at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. As many of you have been asking for my recommendations, whatever that's worth, I'm glad to give them. We posted them more than 2 weeks ago at LarsLarson.com for as many races as we could. Now, I got a lot of people saying here in the Pacific Northwest, do you have a recommendation on every legislative race in Oregon, Washington, Idaho? I don't have the resources, honestly, and by that I just mean time to be able to analyze 150 different legislative races. We have given you recommendations for Congress in Washington State, and there I want to see my current member of Congress, Jamie Herrera Butler, who I consider to be a rhino Republican in name only. I want to see her replaced, and frankly, I think Joe Kent is the best candidate. Now, that didn't go over too well with Heidi St. John. But I just saw something new on Heidi St. John that I want to let you know about, because I think Joe Kent is the best candidate. Now, the primary, as it is, the top two system is going to be in August in Washington State. The primary for Oregon and Idaho is going to be a week from tomorrow in May. But Heidi St. John, Gateway Pundit, is reporting today she's running against Joe Kent, who's been endorsed by Donald Trump. And it turns out that Heidi St. John has blasted Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a member of Congress that I admire wholeheartedly. In a video obtained by the Gateway Pundit, St. John is seen repeatedly condemning Greene for even attending an America First convention to share her views with the crowd. When asked if she would endorse Greene despite making the mistake of guilt by association, Heidi St. John said, "No, I refuse to do that." Quote, "I think we need to be careful about who we associate with. Our associations tell us an awful lot about who we are. That's why we need to be careful about endorsements." Well, Donald Trump was careful with his endorsement. He did not give it to Heidi St. John for a good reason. And now she's showing her true colors by saying she doesn't want to endorse Marjorie Taylor Greene. Now, I don't know about you. I admire what Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene has been able to do and her backbone, because an awful lot of Republicans do not have a backbone. Jamie Herrera Butler does not have a backbone. Apparently, Heidi St. John does not either. Greene has maintained she did nothing wrong by speaking at the event, which was attended primarily by young conservatives. It doesn't matter if I'm speaking to Democrat union members or 1,200 young conservatives who feel cast aside and marginalized. The Pharisees in the Republican Party may attack me for being willing to break barriers and speak to a lost generation of young people who are desperate for love and leadership. Now, Donald Trump, as I said, has endorsed Joe Kent, and Heidi St. John is showing her true colors. I hope you consider that when you consider your vote in August. Now let's go to Joe, who's a naysayer. Joe, we love the naysayers. We've got plenty of time. Let's get right to what you and I disagree about today. What is it?
Well, the documentary, first of all, before I start on that, I'll just say the definition of a rhino is a Republican with common sense. Okay, from that point,
okay, you want to debate something else, we can debate something else, but a rhino is somebody who pretends to be a Republican but really doesn't act like a Republican. But
I say a Republican with common sense, that's the definition. Saying this documentary is a red herring. It's another red herring. It's like a Mike Lindell
No, don't tell me what it's like. Joe, tell me why it's a red herring to say they went out and they got a massive amount of data. They looked at the cell phone tracking pings that are gathered up, and this is used by law enforcement. It was used to target people after the January 6th incident. It's very accurate. The CDC has used it to try to test whether people are socially distancing. Why is it a red herring to say we have people who are acting as human mules caught on video cameras stuffing ballot boxes? How is that a red herring?
Because the data, like Mike Lindell's data, you can put a lot of data out there, and somebody will refute it, or somebody will agree with it.
No, but Joe, you're not refuting it. You're just saying you could do that.
This documentary, of course, Lars, has an agenda, as you have an agenda, to discredit democracy.
No, not to discredit democracy, to discredit ballot box stuffing.
Absolutely. You want to tear down democracy. You want to say Trump is a king. He should be reelected.
No, I don't want him to be a king either, and nor does he want to be. Let me ask you a question, Joe. If people harvested ballots and harvesting ballots is illegal, and there is now documented proof that people were harvesting ballots and stuffing them in ballot boxes, isn't your vote and my vote very much at risk if we vote, but then somebody takes illegal votes and stuffs the ballot box? Supporting democracy is saying you can't do the things that are illegal to do, and stuffing ballot boxes is illegal.
I would agree with that, but I don't agree with the documentary unless it's validated.
Can I ask you a key question here, Joe? Have you seen the documentary? I want to know, Joe, you're speaking of a documentary. Have you actually watched it?
No, I haven't watched it.
Well, then how can you speak to the documentary that you haven't even watched?
Because you're talking about data. You're talking about data mining. Let's talk with
Mike. What's wrong with data mining? Almost every private company in America does data mining.
Mike Lindell's data was Mike Lindell.
We're not talking about Mike Lindell, Joe. We're talking about True the Vote. They did data mining. Are you saying that data mining? You know what, Joe? You're just being a knucklehead. Because I'm asking you, is the data valid or not? And if it's not, how do you know it's not?
It's been validated by government sources.
No, it wasn't. It was actually validated by the video that the government shot of those ballot boxes being stuffed in the middle of the night. And Joe is telling you, don't believe a documentary that Joe hasn't even seen with his own eyes, because he has no eyes to see or ears to hear, apparently. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network. We try to make it honestly provocative talk radio for the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And you're invited to that conversation. And if you're a naysayer, we'll put you right to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com, and you could join me in welcoming back to the program Maria Frost, who is director of the Cole Center for Transportation at the Washington Policy Center. Maria, it's been a while since you've been on. I'm glad to have you back.
Thank you for having me, Lars.
So tell me this. You've made the case that Governor Jay Inslee of Washington State stopped providing ferry service to many Washingtonians because of bad press. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so when the vaccine mandate was imposed by the governor, there were a lot of State Department of Transportation staff, specifically those working for the ferry system, who took sick leave and vacation and did walkouts and various protests, understandably, of the mandate. And in early October, there was a pretty significant amount of service that had to be cut because people weren't showing up for work. And so around that time, the secretary met with the governor to talk about how to deal with that. And on October 16th, the Department of Transportation made the choice to cut service pretty significantly, they said, to increase reliability for riders. And then obviously we know on October 18th, there was massive layoffs, over 400 employees of the Department of Transportation. What public disclosure requests have revealed is that when the secretary met with the governor actually advised the secretary not to make those service reductions, but Secretary Millar insisted on the service reductions not to increase reliability for the public, but as a PR strategy to protect the image of the agency. And so in an email to his staff talking about how his meeting with the governor went, Secretary Millar said, "I strongly recommended making reductions now. It'll be a story one time. Daily missed sailings will be a daily story." And so the department made that choice to cut service broadly, inconvenience hundreds of riders, as a PR strategy.
I mean, because for some of these people, Maria, there are people, I don't live on an island, but if you lived on one of the many islands around Puget Sound and you get used to saying, well, I can catch a couple of ferries in the morning going into, say, Seattle, and a couple of ferries in the evening, and all of a sudden there's one sailing in and one sailing out, and if you miss it, you're literally stranded until the next day. That's the situation some of these people found themselves in, right?
Yes, it was terrible. I mean, I have friends who were in that situation. It was terrible. And on the one hand, I understand the department, you know, saying I don't believe them now, of course, thanks to this public disclosure. But on the one hand, you know, some might argue, they would argue, look, we just made these service cuts so people don't make these plans and end up stranded. But on the other hand, it's clear that wasn't the driving motivator in that decision. And frankly, I don't think that how they look, you know, in the public's eye and how the press deal with them should be a motivator when they decide what service to provide. The public pays them to provide that service, so they need to do their best to do that on a day-to-day basis rather than just trying to cover themselves and make themselves look good. And, you know, disappointingly, another one of the emails that was sent back to Secretary Millar in response was from another one of his deputy directors, I think, and she agreed with his recommendation to the governor, but also made this comment. She said, the longer we don't reduce service, the more dramatic the reductions will look later October. And what she's saying there is like, hey, the added benefit of making these cuts now is because in about a week, we're going to be firing a bunch of people. Let's make the cuts now rather than making broad cuts after all the firings, because we don't want it to look as bad as we know it will be. To me, that is just really atrocious and really inappropriate for a public agency.
Well, and Maria, you know what I'd like to know? I mean, maybe both of these guys came in to the meeting, the governor and Millar, and just quietly agreed not to even talk about the alternative, which would be, let's give some more latitude to employees who say, I'm not taking the shot, and if you make me do it, I'm going to quit, or I'm not going to show up, and I'm going to take as much vacation as I can. Did either one of them say, maybe we should reconsider the mandate, and maybe we should back off on this and actually provide the service that we get paid to provide? And if neither one of them brought that issue up, I'd love to ask Millar, and I'll tell you what, we'll put a request in. I don't have any great hopes of getting him on the show, but I'd like to know, did you ever say to the governor, Governor, these mandates are going to cripple the service the people have already paid for. Maybe we should reconsider them and either soften them up or forgive them altogether. Because there are a bunch of private companies that initially went with a mandate for the jab, and then later said, and some of them airlines I'm thinking of, where they said, no, we're going to back off from the mandate. We're going to make it more voluntary, because they realized they were about to cripple themselves. Now, that's the private sector. But in the government sector, apparently it's screw the public. Who cares?
Yeah, I mean, I think that would be a more than appropriate, long overdue conversation for them to have. This vaccine mandate is harmful. It is yielding negative returns. There are real trade-offs here. It's not, you know, it's not just about COVID. You have to consider other realities, especially, you know, and we saw this very clearly last winter when, for all the passes were closed for 4 days, halting mobility for the entire state. I mean, there's safety issues for the public. There are safety issues for existing staff who are stretched thin, working 7 days a week. That's what happened last winter. I mean, at this point, I frankly am shocked the vaccine mandate is still in place. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, especially, Maria, because I know there are people who deeply believe in the vaccine. I don't. But if you believe in it, but you say, from a practical standpoint, it doesn't seem to offer that much protection against the new variants. It's not, you know, we were told way back when, if we get a vaccine, as soon as we get to 60 or 70% vaccination, we're going to basically wipe this disease out. That isn't happening either. So you're getting the cost of the mandate without what was supposed to be the benefit of the mandate, aren't you?
Right, the reduction in transmission. I mean, supposedly this was supposed to help, keep COVID from spreading, but we are seeing that both vaccinated and unvaccinated people can spread COVID. And so, well, you know, at this point...
In fact, Maria, if I can interject, didn't Seattle just have an entire cruise ship where the entire cruise ship, their entire staff, all the passengers on board were all vaccinated, and they still had a major outbreak, and they had to cancel the sailing, right?
Well, we're seeing in King County, I mean, there were headlines not too long ago about the COVID spike in King County in general, which has some of the highest vaccination rates in the state. And so I think it's pretty clear that the COVID vaccine does not reduce transmission. There are certainly, you know, people may argue there are benefits, as, you know, with regard to, you know, keeping people who are infected with COVID from ending up in the hospital or dying and reducing some of those side effects. But those should be personal decisions that people are able to make for themselves.
They should. That's Maria Frost. She's the director of the Cole Center for Transportation, the Washington Policy Center. When we come back, I've been warning you for years now about the power brownouts and the blackouts. Well, now even the Wall Street Journal says they're coming. We'll get to that in your phone calls. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I just want to tell you something that oftentimes I had this experience. I will tell people on the show about a problem that is coming at them. But for many of them, it's a bit like being on the river. You see, I don't have a boat anymore, but Tina and I used to love to take our little sailboat out on the river. And what the Coast Guard always tells you is, you look up or down the river and you see a boat that's literally a mile away, a bigger boat than yours. And you say, well, I don't have to worry about that boat. It's coming my direction, but it's a mile away. Well, even if that boat's only pulling a few knots down that river, you have to worry because in about 10 minutes, that boat can be right on top of you. And yet, when I tell people about problems that are coming at us, until they actually arrive and they actually start to have an effect on people, I have this experience. I could talk about something for literally years on the radio, a new tax, some other kind of problem that's coming at us. And until the problem actually arrives right in front of somebody, they say, oh, yeah, I'll worry about that later. So for a number of years, I've been warning you that America is heading in the direction of power shortages, blackouts and brownouts, the kind of thing that ordinarily you only see in a third world country. Like Iraq used to be a third world country. Iraq was a country where in most of the country, the power did not stay on 24 hours a day. And in fact, you are considered a fortunate community if the power was even on for 6 or 8 hours a day. And you say, well, how do you live in that kind of circumstance? And you say, well, you plan around it. You plan that refrigerated food may go bad, frozen food may melt, that the things you plan to do were simply not going to be possible except for a few hours a day. Now, that's not a first world country. America is very much a first world country. It's a modern technological country. So I've been telling people what is happening on a sort of a macro basis is that the greenies out there have decided to wage war on fossil fuels. Now, most of us tend to think of fossil fuels as your car or your truck and putting diesel or gasoline in the tank. But what you should understand is that about 60% of the electricity that powers our modern society comes from fossil. It doesn't come from coal, or it doesn't come from nuclear. It doesn't come from hydro. You get small amounts from hydro. You get small amounts from nuclear. You get some from natural gas that's used to generate power. But about almost two-thirds of the power is still coming from fossil fuel. And what happens is the greenies say, we're going to turn off all those plants. And many of them at a cost that is literally hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars. Because if you're a major power utility and the green forces in society today say, we're going to turn off your coal plant. We're going to make it so expensive you can no longer operate it. That's one mechanism. They do it through regulation. And then they do it through wokeness, where they talk to a utility and they say, you should really turn off all that coal-fired power that you're using. If the next question that anybody at a utility says is, what are we supposed to replace it with? They say, well, we're going to have wind and solar. Wind and solar account for less than 10% of America's power grid, and it has taken decades to get to that less than 10%, and has taken hundreds of billions of dollars, if not trillions of dollars, to be able to build that small amount of wind and solar. So what happens when you turn off the coal-fired power plants and you lose the nuclear, because most of the nuclear plants in America are half a century old, which means at some point they age out and they get shut down as well. And inexplicably, the Greens don't want to have anything to do with nuclear, even though arguably, if you're worried about CO2 in the atmosphere, nuclear is the best kind of electricity you could have anywhere. Well, consider this report from the Wall Street Journal this past weekend. From California to Texas to Indiana, electric grid operators are warning that power generating capacity is currently struggling to keep up with demand, a gap that could lead to rolling blackouts during heat waves or other peak periods as soon as this year. Now, do you think people should take that warning seriously? Or should we just wait until the lights go out and you say, gosh, why didn't somebody tell us the lights might go out? The piece goes on. It says California's grid operator announced Friday that it's anticipating a shortfall in supplies this summer. The Mid-Continental Independent System Operator, known as MISO, which oversees a large regional grid spanning much of the Midwestern United States, said late last month that capacity shortages may force it to take emergency measures to meet summer demand. In Texas, where a number of power plants lately were offline for maintenance, the grid operator warned of tight conditions during a heat wave expected to last into this week. The risk of electricity shortages is rising throughout the United States, and here's where this is exactly what I warned you was going to happen. As traditional power plants are being retired more quickly than they can be replaced by renewable energy and battery storage, power grids are feeling the strain as the U.S. makes a historic transition from conventional power plants fueled by coal and natural gas to cleaner forms of energy. Now, that's what the greenies want. And they don't care if your lights get turned out. In fact, if they send the message, you shouldn't be using that electricity anyway. California regulators said on Friday as much as 3,800 megawatts of new supplies may face delays through 2025. Such delays could pose a major challenge to the state, which is racing to procure a huge amount of renewable energy and storage to offset the closure of several gas-fired power plants. When the lights start going out, just be aware that the warning was there. We provided the warning, and people said, yeah. Because they've grown up in an America where the power, unless there was a storm that knocked tree branches down, for the most part, American electric power stays on 24/7, 365. Well, get used to us being a third world country, because that is where Joe Biden is taking us. To your calls now. Let's go to Brian first. Hey, Brian, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Good afternoon, Lars. Long time listener. And like I told your call screener, I'm not sure if I'm a naysayer or not, but your conversation with the doctor about the vaccine.
Yeah.
Yes. I'll just start off with saying I am an immunosuppressed person.
Okay. And you made a decision about the vaccine. Do we disagree about that? That's your decision to make.
I will never get jabbed. And my naysaying might go against the doctor, not necessarily you, because I was hospitalized with COVID.
I'm sorry to hear that. I'm glad you made it.
In my room that was there for 2.5 weeks who was vaccinated. I am not, never will be. I was only in the hospital for 4 days.
Good.
I treated myself with God's natural vitamins and supplements and overcame COVID.
That's the way to get it done. Brian, I'm glad that you came out of it well, and it should be your choice to take the vaccine or not. You've got the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I want to get back to your phone calls and emails in just a moment, but there's an important issue I want you to be aware of, and Terry Schilling, who is the president of the American Principles Project, joins me now. Terry, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Lars. Love coming on and talking with you.
Well, tell me about this. The Biden administration has a plan, and they have lots of plans. Most of them don't seem to work out all that well, like leaving Afghanistan or guarding the border, things like that. Now they have a plan to overhaul the way that schools respond to sexual misconduct complaints, and they want to extend federal protection to some of the most vulnerable students. Now, that all sounds good on paper. Tell me how it's actually going to work out or likely to work out.
So what the Biden administration is going to be doing is changing the regulations when it comes to sexual misconduct complaints. What they're going to be doing there is essentially removing due process. So they're going to make it easier for frivolous complaints being made against our sons and daughters, for that matter. And they're going to be taking away their due process rights and essentially establishing a system of guilty until proven innocent. Under the Trump administration, they got rid of a lot of these regulations that Obama had taken into consideration. Now, before I go on to the changes that they're making to Title IX, Lars, I just want to be very clear. Democrats and these woke progressives really don't care about sexual assault. And you don't need to look very far. You only need to go to Loudoun County, Virginia, where a young woman was raped in the bathroom by a guy in a dress in the women's bathroom. Yep. They moved that kid, they covered it up, and then they moved that boy to another school where he sexually assaulted another 14-year-old girl. These people don't care about this. I just think it's important to point that out. This is all a farce.
And
then,
this is
when it comes to Title IX.
Yeah, this is going to be most. Is this both K-12 and college, or is the bigger concern in K-12 education?
No, this is everything. This is K-12 and higher education. This is Title IX as the Department of Education is going to interpret the law, and that affects everywhere that's receiving federal dollars. So if you're taking federal money, it applies to you, and the vast majority of our colleges accept federal money.
Now, you said that this goes beyond that concern, because clearly the Biden administration wants to side with transgender, LGBTQ, and all that, but they're going to do it at the expense of not only victimizing some people, assaults that will happen because of what, you know, the case in Loudoun County is one I cite all the time, where the school literally covered up what the student had done before and allowed him, pretending to be a girl, to do it again. But it's also going to it's going to pose a threat, as you said, to young men who are going to be accused of things they didn't do, and they're not going to get due process.
That's exactly right. And Lars, just to go back to Loudoun County, the Department of Justice and the Department of Education conspired to investigate the parents who were upset about this sexual assault, that were showing up at their school board meeting upset and rightfully yelling at these school board officials for covering up. They invested them under the Homeland Security Act. They investigated them as domestic terrorists. They don't care about sexual assault. They care about protecting their special interest groups. So when it's a sexual assault from a transgender person, they're going to favor the transgender person over the girl because that's more important, and transgender rights always trump women's rights, which gets to the changes that they're making in Title IX. This would reinterpret protections on the basis of sex to mean gender identity. And so how does that affect us? Well, that means that boys who identify as girls are going to be able to go into our daughters' locker rooms, into their showers, into their bathrooms, and also, and this seems like a small thing, into our daughters' sports. This sets up a clash, Lars, between the states who are pushing back against all this nonsense and the federal government. It's not the way to unite this country.
I'm talking to Terry Schilling, who's the president of the American Principles Project. And Terry, I've been warning people for several years now, saying, are you ready to sit down and have a conversation with your daughter or your granddaughter and say, I know you had planned to be a golfer or a tennis player or any of these other sports and maybe even be good enough to pay for your college education through a scholarship. You better just pretty much put those dreams aside, because you're going to be beat by biological males. And if you're not ready to have that conversation, you need to show up at the school board and demand that the rules not be written that way. You think I'm off base in suggesting that to people?
No, I think you're mostly on track, Lars. I just I think that what we've seen, what America has done really, really well in the past 2 years is we've been showing up at the school board meetings. We've been pushing back. But those school board officials aren't listening to us. So we have to unelect the vast majority of them. There are 13,000 school districts across the country, and there are over 93,000 school board seats. A good portion of those seats go unchallenged and unfilled. That needs to change. So you don't just need to show up at your school board meeting. You have to run for office yourself. I mean, so many people ask me, what do I do? How do I fight back? How do I get engaged? You get engaged by running. You get engaged by finding someone to run. And we often just take this for granted and we show up at the meetings only and then go home. You have to actually put your name out there, because if you don't do it, no one will.
No, and by the way, Terry, I can say that for 25 years on this show, I've had people calling saying, well, how do I get involved? I said, run for school board. And they kind of sneer like, oh, no, I want to run for Congress or the legislature or governor. And I say, no, run for the school board. You become one vote in five or one vote in seven, depending on the school board, on literally tens of billions of dollars and some of the most consequential government activity you can ever imagine. And I think a lot of people have never thought of it that way, but I've been banging on that drum for basically a quarter of a century, saying run for that job. You may find it more consequential than being one of 90 in the state legislature or maybe one of 435 in the House of Representatives. Which one do you think is more consequential?
Well, I think you're exactly right. Although I will say that these states and the federal government control so much money now that they have such an outsized influence on what these school boards do. A lot of the reasons why these school board officials aren't making any changes is because they're worried that if they do, they will lose out on millions of dollars that they are counting on at the local level. Now, to you and I, who are principled, that, you know, we would make that call and we'd figure out how to raise the money elsewhere, or we'd make the cuts to the administrators, right? I mean, that's what we don't talk about really, is 50% of school budgets across the country are just administration, right? They're just people filling out grant requests and all this other garbage federal guidelines. You can do a lot by downsizing the federal government and the role there. Exponentially, you do a lot.
Well, and in fact, Terry, I've told people one of the colleges I admire the most, I've never even set foot on the campus, is Hillsdale. Because way back when, Hillsdale said, we're not going to let the federal government tell us what to do. This was even in the 70s. Because they said the federal government wants to come in and tell us we have to give degrees to Black Americans and female Americans. And they said, we've been giving degrees to Black Americans and female Americans since before the Civil War. We're not going to be told how to do it, because we were doing it back when the federal government was still actively discriminating against people based on gender and based on skin color. So they said, we won't take a single dime. In fact, if a student comes to us with a Pell Grant for $2,000, we'll find a way to raise the money so we don't take one thin dime from the federal government. And that way, when the federal government comes to us and tells us what to do, we can say, go pound sand. We are immune to your nonsense. We don't take your money, and we never will. Terry Schilling is the president of the American Principals Project. Terry, it's always a pleasure to have you on. Parents, you got to know what's happening to your sons and your daughters. We'll be back in just a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Naysayers go first at 866-439-5277. You've got the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Now, you know who I endorsed for the governor's race in Oregon, even though I don't vote in Oregon. I vote in Washington State, and we don't have a governor's race this year. But I will be voting for Joe Kent. But in Oregon, it's Bridget Barton. And having talked to Bob Tiernan, I've known Bob for probably 20 years, and he's a very nice guy. He's served in uniform. I admire all of that. But his answer to say that Joe Biden was legitimately elected as president of the United States, and he hasn't even seen the most recent documentary proof that that's not true, shame on Bob. But we're going to invite him back after he's seen 2,000 mules. It was an interview. We're going to post that interview. You can find it at LarsLarson.com, just like all the interviews that I do on this show. So you get a chance to check it out. But his lack of any kind of sensible answer I don't often ask questions of people, although I do aspire to do this, but I don't often ask questions that stop them in their tracks. That one stopped Bob Tiernan in his tracks, and I encourage you to take a listen to it when we post it online at LarsLarson.com. Let's go to your calls. Let's go to Ted, who's calling in from Kent, Washington. Hey, Ted, welcome to the program, and thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Thank you for having me, Lars. It's that Wall Street Journal article on brownouts and blackouts.
Yep.
The whole green energy thing is such a bait and switch. There's no way that they are capable of using those wind, solar, and battery technologies to fulfill our power requirements. Can you imagine a battery storage plant? Say they got 10,000 really big lithium-ion batteries. That's the kind of thing that they envision. Can you imagine the fire? You know those things like to catch on fire because it's difficult to make them in large volumes, in large quantities, and make them high enough quality to where you don't have that
Well,
problem.
Ted, even if I allow them, there is a technology called pumped storage, and it's actually already used across America. It's been around for decades. And people will say, well, we're not just talking about batteries themselves. We're talking about pumped storage, or we're talking about ammonia is another way to store energy. But even if you allow all of that, none of that technology is ready to right now on the kind of scale they need to be able to supply it. It'd be like coming to your family and saying, by the way, we're going to heat our home this winter with wood. And you say, we don't even have a wood stove. And you say, well, we're going to get one. And you say, but Dad, that's not enough to heat the whole house. Well, on nights when it's really cold, we're all going to sleep in one room. And, you know, we'll have one wood stove. And they say, how about we wait until we can actually make ourselves self-sufficient for energy? And we'll do it that way. And you know, this is... Huh?
We need to put pressure on our legislators to tell the power companies, no, you're going to make real plans for fulfilling for doing your job. Maybe the way to go is this, Lars. If we tell the greenies, hey, you know what, you're only going to be able to use your computer about 3-4 hours a day.
The elites all know that they're all, you know, you're not going to watch Nancy Pelosi's lights go out. Well, I mean, her lights are out mentally. They have been for a while, but. You know what this reminds me of, Kent? Kent, there are people out there, and I could imagine this. Have you ever had a friend who said he really hates his current job?
Sure.
Okay. And my advice to people is find the new job before you leave the old job. And I think that always works out. Okay, but I will say that there are some people out there who realize they themselves will never get off the dime about finding the new job till they quit their current job. Now, it's a dangerous play because you walk in, you give notice, and you say, okay, now I have no job, I have no income, now I have to find that better job, right? And it also limits your choices because you have to do it quickly. I mean, most people don't have enough money stuff aside to do that for very long. This is what the greenies are doing. They're saying, we're going to turn off all these power sources. And you say, what are they going to replace it with? Well, this other kind of power. And you say, well, where is this other kind of power? This is the equivalent of quitting your current job, saying, I realize that if I quit my current job, I'll have to find another job right away. The problem is you've now constrained all your options down to, I basically have to take the next job that comes along. Except when it comes to energy, If you quit all those other forms of power, you turn off the nuclear, you turn off the natural gas, you turn off the coal, and the Pacific Northwest right now, we used to have 12 coal-fired plants, most of them outside of Oregon and Washington, that feed the region. We also had a couple inside, Centralia, Coal, I think 1 and 2, and then Boardman. Well, they've already turned Boardman off, and they promised when they made the plans to do that about 15 years ago, they said, we're going to replace it by burning cheatgrass. And then that didn't work. And they said, well, we can use nat gas. And the greenies said, no, you can't use nat gas. Even though America has tons and tons of nat gas available, you can't do any of that. And so even as you get into the replacements, the greenies have objections to all of them, including wind, including solar. And by the way, who are we buying almost all of our wind from and almost all of our solar from? The Chinese communists, Joe Biden's buddies. So, will there be enough of it? And the answer is no, there won't. But the elites, You won't see Jay Inslee sitting in the dark. You won't see Kate Brown sitting in the dark. And other than mentally, you won't see Joe Biden sitting in the dark. There, and his energy czar, you know, this gas bag, John Kerry.
Oh, goodness. He'll still be. Oh,
he'll still be. No, John Kerry will still be running around on his private jet telling the rest of us how we have to save the planet. But believe me, that's not going to stop him from firing up those engines and going anywhere he wants to go. Ted, thanks for the call from Ken. Thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.